Okay, I know that's little and hard to read, so I'm not going to test you, it's all right. But I also don't want to have to give you all that information, so I'll sort of refer to it and you can come up and look later if it doesn't make any sense. This is a historical timeline that kind of overlays what's happening in the land of Palestine through the period that Jeremiah is active. So today I'm introducing Jeremiah to you. Over the next few months we're doing a sporadic series on Jeremiah, looking at bits and pieces. There's going to be quite a lot of information in it today, so that's just the way it is today. So as you go today, my invitation to you is to listen for what strikes you and what echoes your experience. The question we always ask the kids in Godly Play when we tell an Old Testament story is, where are you in this story, or what part of this story is about you? So I'm going to invite that to be your question today as I put quite a lot of stuff out there. So Jeremiah is the longest book in the Bible. If you want to find it, just open your Bible right in the middle. It falls open at Jeremiah. Unless you've got a study Bible or a Catholic Bible, then you're going to go slightly to the right. Jeremiah, the timeline starts up there at the time of David, and then there's between David and Solomon, they've got really long rules, but after Solomon, the kingdom of Israel splits into the north and south. You've got a couple more hundred years. The Assyrians destroy the north. Judah in the south continues on. The Assyrians are the regional superpower and they are tyrants. But by the middle of the 600s, their power is starting to wane. So when Josiah comes to the throne, Josiah comes to the throne as an eight-year-old. By the time he's an adult, the power of Assyria is starting to get a bit wobbly. So there's room for a vassal state to push back a little bit. So Josiah implements political and religious reforms. Assyria, as part of conquering the nation, has put statues of their gods in the temple. So Jerusalem is not destroyed by Assyria. The northern kingdom's totally wiped out, but the southern kingdom still becomes a state of the Assyrian Empire. They still have to pay tribute to Assyria. So, and that includes having their gods in their temples. Josiah takes the temple, the gods of Assyria, out of Jewish places, which is a significant revolt against the empire, and he gets away with it. So he's heralded as a hero. Taken a step in the direction you're supposed to be of returning the worship of Yahweh. About Jeremiah the prophet is about the same age as Josiah. So a year before Josiah starts his reforms, Jeremiah reportedly has a call to be a prophet of God. So he's probably a young man in his early 20s. The red on there is the life of Jeremiah, the ministry life of Jeremiah, and the blue is the exile. He starts prophesying in the time of Josiah when things are looking good. They're pushing back against Assyria. They've had the most peace and independence they've had in years. Jeremiah says, doom is coming. It's all falling apart. Don't get comfortable. Actually, things are terrible and it's going to go very, very badly for you. And of course, people think he's an idiot and they don't listen. The superpowers around them change their power balance. Assyria falls. Egypt has a go at taking over. They rule Judah for a few years. And then Babylon conquers Egypt. And so Judah becomes a vassal state of Babylon. But it's just business as usual, really, just with a different external empire that you've got to pay excessive tax to. All through this time, Jeremiah is at work. And then around 600, Judah ceases to pay tribute to Babylon. And this is when the trouble starts. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, sends an army, besieges Jerusalem, conquers Jerusalem and takes into exile a whole lot of the leaders of Jerusalem. That's in 597. But he doesn't destroy Jerusalem. He leaves Jerusalem, sets up Zedekiah as the king, steps away. After about 5 years, Zedekiah also tries to revolt, and so Nebuchadnezzar comes back, besieges Jerusalem for 2 years, and at the end of that siege, totally sacks and destroys the place, burns the temple, levels the city, takes a second group of people into exile, sets up a governor in Judah who some Judean separatists promptly assassinate, and then a third lot are exiled So over 17 years, there are three waves of exile to Babylon. Some of the remnant people who are left in Judah flee to Egypt, and they take Jeremiah with them by force. He doesn't want to go. He wants to stay in the land, but they force him to go with them to Egypt. And he dies in Egypt around 580, we think. So his ministry covers about 45 years. It's this long series of the life. We get these anecdotes of the life work of a man who this has been his mission. And within that, for the people of Judah, a couple of things to note. The people who are exiled are the elites and the leaders, but the majority of the population is not exiled. The poor people and the majority of the population are left behind, particularly the agricultural labourers, the workers, the poor, and people in the northern cities are left behind. Some estimates say as many as 250,000 people got left behind and only about 10,000 got taken. That's probably a bit of an exaggeration, but maybe about a quarter of the population was removed and three quarters were left behind. But the ones who were removed then reimagine who Israel is, who they are, who God is, and that experience of exile fundamentally shapes the people of God and who they are and who they think of themselves as. The destruction of Jerusalem, I cannot overstate how devastating this was for them. It wasn't just that it was a physical loss, but it destroyed their identity, and it was intended to. That's why they did it. The temple of the royal family, the temple, the palace of the royal family, the walls of Jerusalem, these things defined who they were as the people of God. They were the economic structures, the social structures, the political structures, and the spiritual structures of their whole society, and these were flattened. So the exile, even though the number of people who were exiled is not a majority of the population, the experience of having their identity destroyed is shared. And the people who then have to rethink, who are we? How do we know God? Does God go with us? Is God there in this trauma of national communal identity? I don't know where I'm up to, never mind. So then we get Jeremiah. So Jeremiah is a character based on a real person. What we get in our text is a character. It's not a biography. You get quite a lot of biographical details, and they are the things that the authors are putting in there to help build up the character to tell their story. It's little snippets of this long life work. Begins in the time of Josiah. Overall, our Bible is very positive about Josiah. There are some bits in Jeremiah where Jeremiah says Josiah didn't actually go far enough and his reforms were a failure even at the time. After Josiah died before the Babylonians really came in power, and when he died, his reforms hadn't really taken hold. So after he died, they all faded away and things went back to how they were. So the official line is that Josiah did a good thing and then the people failed once he died. But there's evidence of Jeremiah saying, actually, he was a failure anyway. He just did a window dressing of reform and didn't actually change the hearts of the people, or possibly even his own. So Jeremiah's a Levite. He's from a priestly family. He's probably not actually a priest, but he comes from a Levite town about 5 km outside Jerusalem. He has, because of that heritage, he has some connections in high places, which are quite useful when his life's threatened later on. He lives through both the sieges of Jerusalem. So he sees many of his friends and associates killed or exiled because he's in the elite circles of the people who are taken away. As his message becomes increasingly treasonous, because his message, he keeps saying, God will no longer protect you in Jerusalem. You need to surrender to the Babylonians. This is not popular. And it's particularly as they're under siege, it undercuts the morale. So at that point, the incident about him getting chucked in the well because it's time to get rid of him is because they've been under siege for over a year and they don't want a voice saying, actually, we should give up now. that's not helping their cause. But he is saying God wishes, he says it as strongly as he says, the Babylonians are the servants of God now, which is a startling thing to say about the power of empire that is coming to crush the nation. And it comes to pass that they crush the nation. Jeremiah's in the lineup to be exiled, but the Babylonian captain of the guard sees him, recognises him and says, oh, he's on our side. Would you like to come to Babylon or would you like to stay here? Jeremiah says, I'll stay here, thanks very much. So he doesn't get exiled. He stays in the land, although then the people who are left take him to Egypt by force, so he does end up getting exiled by his own people. He urges those who aren't exiled to stay in the land, this is where we need to be. But they're afraid, particularly after the governor is assassinated, the people are very afraid and the remaining people of power flee to Egypt. He's known, Jeremiah is sometimes referred to as the weeping prophet because there's these agonised laments at the destruction coming and experienced. He's also recorded within the text that at the time he was known as terror on every side because of the content of his prophecies of doom. He's recorded as hating the message that he feels compelled to give. There's an incident where he fronts up with another prophet who's saying, peace, peace, everything will be fine. And Jeremiah says, oh, I would like your message to be true. But it's not. And he feels betrayed by God. He's not cozy with God while he tells everyone else things are going apart. He feels personally betrayed through the whole experience. He's unpopular, he's a minority, he's marginalised, but events prove him right. So his very few followers hold on to his words and somehow weave them into our sacred tradition. So that's the character of Jeremiah. So the question from the start is, where are you in this story? Or what part of this story is about you? As you meet Jeremiah, and then we have Jeremiah, the book. The book is a collage of bits and pieces chucked together. It's poetry, it's prose, it's got no chronological order, it doesn't seem to have much of a structural order. It has really violent imagery. We didn't read the worst of it this morning. It has poignant, beautiful poetry. It has narrative description, it has little biographical anecdotes, it has oracles of disaster. It's just this hodgepodge of stuff that's all put together. The bits I got Luke to read out made it sound almost like it was a cohesive start to finish, but it's really not. That was very selective reading on my part. And because of that, as we do this series on Jeremiah, we won't be going in chapter order. It'll come and go as we feel we've got things to say or invite people to speak. So, but roughly what you've got in 52 chapters of Jeremiah is 10 chapters at the start that are solidly prophecies of doom in poetry form. And the argument is throughout, God will destroy Judah because Judah has failed to uphold the covenant. On two grounds. The first is that they've loved other gods, and the second is that they've failed to act justly and protect the poor. Baal, the god of the Canaanite god, the Assyrian god, is not just a problem because it's an empty idol with nothing in it. Baal was a god who supported the hierarchy. Baal was a god who encouraged kings to be tyrants. And Baal had no interest in the poor. Whereas Yahweh is a god of the poor. And Yahweh calls leaders to protect the poor as part of their core role. So to worship Baal was not about just worshipping an empty statue. It was to adhere to an ideology fundamentally opposed to the basic values of Yahweh. And they were practicing child sacrifice to Yahweh, which remarkably is not the main argument for why they should be destroyed. It would be if I wrote Jeremiah. But it's in there. And Jeremiah has to say, do you really think Yahweh wants this? Yahweh has never asked for this. Don't do this. The valley that gets called hell in the New Testament is the valley where they sacrifice children in this period. That's where our imagery of hell comes from. So then we have another 10 chapters of lament, in which Jeremiah wrestles with God. He suffers personally, he grieves for the people, and the language, the voice of when it's Jeremiah and when it's God is very blurred. God grieves for the people, God laments. Now we're up to chapter 21 to 28 roughly, you get more narrative about the fate of the nation and about Jeremiah's interactions with the alternate prophets of his day who have a very different message to give. Jeremiah is a prophet of doom and they are prophets of good news and peace. Then we get four chapters, 29 to 33, of comfort. That's five chapters. Comfort, restoration, the mercy of God. God loves you. God will build you up. And then we're back to more narratives of the end. We get 34 to 45, we get more narratives then of the end of Judah, the southern kingdom, the collapse, into the exile. And then 46 to 51, we get a whole series of oracles of doom against all the other countries around, including two whole chapters on the destruction of Babylon, the great tyrant, and how evil Babylon is. Babylon, who has repeatedly been called the servant of God earlier in the same book. And a final chapter recaps the narrative to show that Jeremiah was vindicated. It turned out how he said, which probably also implies that the comfort bits that he has said will also come true, although it hasn't happened yet. So this complex text shows lots of multiple editing. There's especially a final editing layer, probably a final layer, that comes out of the exile. The people in the exile, they get called the Deuteronomists, in their rethinking of who God is in that experience of exile, they need to construct a Jewish identity that can survive exile and survive if or when they return to the land. And this group edits the bulk of our Old Testament, especially the history books from Joshua through to Kings and the prophets. And their official theology then is what we often read as the theology of the Bible, which is that God justly allowed them to be destroyed and exiled, but a merciful God will regather and replant, possibly with the involvement of a Messiah. The Messiah idea comes out of exile, but it is not the only theology in our Bible. It's definitely not the only theology in Jeremiah. It's the official voice that comes out of the experience of exile. And to make it even more complicated, we have two different historical texts of Jeremiah, one of which is about an eighth longer than the other one. It's long enough as it is. One in Greek and one in Hebrew, which are several hundred years apart. Quite a lot of it's the same, but it's not all the same. So you've got two different versions of Jeremiah to work with. Fun! So, the major theme, if there's one theme in such a gluey thing, is wrestling with who is God and who are we, Judah at the time. Who are we as God's people? All we thought we were is stripped away. Are we still God's people? Is God still there? Is God still our God? And the key imagery is around falsehood and truth. Jeremiah is very interested in what is true and what is a lie. And there's a whole lot of multiple theologies to try and answer that question. And they are not synthesized and resolved. They sit in there. And each implies, if God is like this, how do I explain disaster? If God is like this, who are we? And these are still good questions for us. If God is like this, how do I explain disaster? If God is like this, who are we? So I'm going to introduce you to some theologies from the Jeremiah, which if you're someone who likes to keep track, I've written down here. That's where we're going. This is for John Scotland, and he's not here. He wanted me to make notes. The first is a royal theology. God promises unilaterally to protect the people of Israel. I'm using Israel and Judah. Israel is when it's the whole nation. Then the northern lot gets called Israel and the southern lot Judah, but the promises relate to the whole. And after the exile, they use Israel for the whole. But even though the exact bit we've got right now is Judah, Israel still is used in terms of the promises and the big picture. So there's this theology that the promises of God to David, centred on the temple, will protect the people because God has mercifully chosen this people for reasons we do not know to be God's people and to be loved and protected for all time. Therefore, we need to uphold the temple system, be core to our values here in the temple, and uphold the monarchy, and things will go well for us. This is the theology of early parts of Isaiah, who comes back here up at 720 when Assyria is threatening Jerusalem. And there's a miraculous story. Assyria besieges Jerusalem and miraculously goes away. And the theology understanding that is that's because God has unilaterally promised to protect the royal family and the temple and therefore Jerusalem and us through it. And it's the theology of the prophets in Jeremiah's day who are speaking against him. And then there's the covenant theology, which is that God has established a relationship with Israel that is mutual and requires loving attention on both sides. But Israel, and now the remnant of Judah, has been unfaithful to God. And so God, because God's character is relentlessly just, God cannot leave evil unpunished, so allows Babylon to destroy the people. It has in it this notion that righteousness is rewarded, that evil is punished, and this is the official explanation for the exile, with a mercy appended. Another option is that this is the Jubilee. God promised the poor the land and restoration, and the elites of the Judean people failed to give it. So God removed them and gave the land directly to the poor. One of the bits Luke read today was where the Babylonians let the poor have the land. So God's justice is enacted not so much in punishing the exiles, but in restoring the futures, the fortunes of the oppressed agricultural labourers. He also brings justice for the children at risk of being sacrificed by destroying the practice of child sacrifice. It's not that there was no suffering and God brought suffering, it's that God has rearranged who is bearing the brunt of the suffering from the powerful, from the weak to the powerful. And this is obviously not the view of the powerful, who are the literate people who wrote the Bible. But it's a useful caution to us when we find ourselves outraged at an abhorrent supposed act of God. Whose side are we on? Are we upset because of a loss of comfort or a loss of the status quo? Who does that status quo protect? Who does that status quo oppress? The reaction in some parts of the church to the Royal Commission into sexual abuse echoes some of this for me, that if the institution of the church is destroyed to protect the children, then whose side is God on and why are we weeping? This is our child sacrifice. All three of these assume that God is in control. God is the author of geopolitical events, and eventually will bring the downfall of evil empires. Things are not as secular as they seem. Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. And Jeremiah both includes the idea that you can change God's mind, this God who controls things, if you repent and follow God. But there's also passages where God says, don't even pray for them. I will not be changed. I have decided. Jeremiah prays for them anyway, which is a very risky thing for Jeremiah to do at that point. They're all attempts to explain a disaster in corporate terms. We are very, very concerned with individuals and individual rights because that's our culture. It's a very individual culture. This text comes out of a profoundly corporate culture. So I, reading this, I'm terribly disturbed by the collateral damage of these big picture, God is in control notions, But the authors of this book are not that concerned because they are so profoundly collective. And does God think collateral damage is okay for a grand plan? The text doesn't say. But it shows two responses from God that I think are interesting. One is when Jeremiah puts the question to God directly, God is silent. And the other is that God is shown to be weeping. Which brings us to another of the theologies held in this book, is God the suffering lover. God who is torn asunder by the violence done to God's people. The laments are in Jeremiah's voice and in God's voice. God remains with them in and through the suffering and works to rebuild them. God suffers. And Jeremiah, as the suffering prophet, embodies the suffering of God, embodies the theology of the suffering lover, becomes it as a parable in himself. And he explicitly articulates the notion that good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, and that's not okay, and it just is. What Jenny Goring, when she lectured at Murdoch on theodicy, called the shit happens theology. And Jeremiah raises this and it sits out there. Why do people get what they don't deserve? And he gets a very Job-like answer. They just do. Another theology I find really interesting that it hasn't been completely erased from the record is the people who flee to Egypt turn on Jeremiah and say, the problem all along, the cause of this disaster, is that Josiah stopped us from worshipping the Queen of Heaven. She was looking after us. And now we'll go back to her, thank you very much, because God has failed, abandoned us, and was no good, and the Queen of Heaven's a much better bet. They need to find an alternate God out of this disaster. It's remarkable to me that that's allowed to stay in the text. It's in there as an example of saying how terribly wrong they are, but it's in there. And then we have these notions that perhaps God changes God's mind through this process. Two different ways this is presented. One, God did perhaps promise to uphold the monarchy, but could no longer do so and changed God's mind to allow destruction and to implement a new system without the intermediary priesthood, the covenant written on their hearts. Another alternative that Walter Brueggemann puts forward is that God changes God's character, that the exile experience for God changes who God is, how God sees God's self, that God was an unyielding God of justice and mutual covenant. But then God witnessed and experienced the impact of what being that God ended up as. The outcome of being an unyielding God of justice was that God's beloved people were destroyed. And that desolation so profoundly shocked God at the depth of God's own love for God's people that God reimagined God's self with a new understanding of faithful love based on a unilateral covenant, a covenant of mercy that doesn't require response. Because the people never repent of their evil. But God, apparently, repents of the decision to destroy them. God's suffering changes God. Where are you in this story? What part of this story is about you? Why have so many images stuck together in one book? Kathleen O'Connor suggests that it's trauma work, that it's a traumatised people out of a psychologically traumatised mind throwing out what a trauma brings up, and that the violent language is a process theology working to a way to move forward. The majority academic position is that the differences are multiple layers of editing. So the views of those who went to Egypt, the ones who remained in the land, the ones who went to Babylon, edited over each other. And the ones who went to Babylon are often given prominence because they are coming back to the land and they need a theology that says we're the real leaders and not you guys who were left behind. If you get into the third part of Isaiah, this struggle between the ones returning and the ones there comes out. Or it could be that they're presented to show how wrong some of them are, to show that the dominant one is right. That works for some of them, but not all of them. I wonder if it's actually about a progression of Jeremiah's own theology, that we start out with an angry young man, passionate for a cause, and then we get the sorrow of an older man when the things he predicted come to pass and his world falls apart. And then we get the mellow reflections of someone looking back over a long life and considering that God was there in all of it, in the good and the bad. God was the hope within the darkness, not after the darkness. And that God will go on in whatever comes, despite a life of many horrors, and Jeremiah lived a life of horrors. Jeremiah finds himself confident that he's dealing with a God of love. Amongst all the violence and doom, the weeping, the loss, Jeremiah the person, or his editors, or the survivors of the exile trauma, or all of them, seem to ultimately conclude that God will be faithfully loving God's people forever. I've talked too long again. I knew I would talk too long. I know, you did well. I was going to ask if there's any questions. We've got a little bit of time for questions, Elise.
Is the
patchwork part of being a defiance against the collective nature of things?
Yeah, and the structure, power structure.
Quite possibly. I think there are, because there's a dominant, the dominant power structure is clearly there, but the fact that everything else isn't erased, I think, is evidence of this bubbling up of other voices saying, no, you can't just wipe us out. Yeah.
Ken.
Two questions, Claire. The bit about the patchwork, would the fact that a lot of people contributed to writing it also contribute to that patchwork in the sense that they all threw their bit in and then it wasn't edited by one person who collated it all and made it consistent?
Possibly. This is what you get when you edit by committee.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. When you get a bunch of people together to write something, it ends up very fragmented. Mm. And unless somebody edits it and collates it at the end, it's pretty messy.
That's one option, yes, and quite likely. In other places, it seems the Deuteronomists have had more strength to pull it together and have their line dominate. So it's somewhat surprising that the editor didn't do a final edit as clearly in this one as they have in other places. So,
yeah. The other question is, you mentioned that there were two versions, a Hebrew and a Greek. I presume the Hebrew is the older one?
No. The Greek is the older one. This is the unusual thing. The Greek is the Septuagint. It was translated into Greek in Egypt about 250 BCE. The earliest fragments of that manuscript we have are from about the time, from about 100 BCE. The earliest full manuscript we have is from 400 AD. The Masoretic text is created in the 7th century Christian era, and the earliest text of it we have is from about the 8th century. So it's about 1,000 years between the translation of the Septuagint and the creation of the Masoretic text. So the Hebrew text, obviously based on something that's been brought through, the Hebrew text is a later text, but that's what our Bible's based on. Our Bible is in general based on the Hebrew Masoretic text from the 8th century, but there's also always reference in commentaries to the Septuagint because the Septuagint, the Greek translation, is what the people of Jesus' time used. So Paul, in his writings, quotes the Septuagint when he quotes Old Testament scripture. Jesus, when he reads in the temple, in the synagogue, almost certainly reads from the Septuagint.
Oh, so, okay. Which one's longer?
In this case, the Hebrew one is longer. The later one is longer. Yeah.